Hello all, and welcome to part three of our three-part Fall Philosophy Walk series. My name is Marisa, and I'm very pleased to be hosting our hike here today on Merlin Nature Preserve, and equally pleased that Mother Nature has decided to jump on the bandwagon and treat us to such a beautiful fall morning. Today we're going to be continuing our discussion about environmental ethics, conservation, preservation, hunting and the ethics of hunting, and governance and policy. We'll be focusing largely on the governance and policy side of things, as well as community involvement. So what can we do to be actively engaged individuals and the dialogue about conservation and wildlife management? Today, our guest speaker is Nick Jivak. Nick serves as the Conservation Director for Montana Wildlife Federation and is a wonderful resource and very knowledgeable. No doubt, I suspect, because of his very unique and varied background. And I will let him give you a little more detail about that so that I don't do it any disservice. Because we have quite a bit of ground to cover today, both literally and metaphorically, especially considering that we will be navigating our way through some snowy terrain, I don't want to take up too much airtime. I would, however, like to very briefly mention that the discussion that we'll be having today happens to be a particularly timely one for us here in Montana as it concerns conservation, wildlife management, and governance and policy. So that's your teaser, and Nick will provide some more insight about that. Nick, with no further ado, it is all you.
Got into journalism, got a master's degree in journalism, worked in Montana as a reporter for 11 years. So, and now I covered every issue in my as a journalist that's relevant to MWF: public lands, wildlife, hunting, you know, natural resource development. All of it. So, and then I've been here 5 years. So, and now the Montana Wildlife Federation has about 5,000 members from in Montana as well as around the nation. And we work on all the policies that affect abundant, you know, a healthy wildlife, healthy habitat, and public opportunity to enjoy those, whether you do that with a gun and a fly rod or a camera or whatever, you know, if you like wildlife. And that doesn't just include game species, but so we work on things as diverse as, you know, the Clean Water Act, mm-hmm. the Clean Air Act, you know, coal development, but we also work on a lot of nuts and bolts stuff about season setting and hunting regulations. And so we're really an all-inclusive wildlife conservation organization. So how do I do that? I lobby the state legislature. I go to every Fish and Wildlife Commission meeting, which is the body, you know, that sets all that policy. I go to the Environmental Quality Council, which is the legislative oversight of the agencies like DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality. I shouldn't use all these acronyms. The Department of Natural Resources and Conservation and Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. A couple times a year, I go to Washington, D.C. for various things that, you know, they want to hear from the sort of grassroots, you know, voices. So I really, when I'm at the legislature, people say, well, you represent hunters and anglers. But I say, what I really represent is wildlife, which really doesn't have a voice up there, you know, or does have a voice in through organizations like ours, as well as organizations like the Sierra Club and the Nature Conservancy and the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. I mean, there's a lot of groups that have banded together. So our priority is abundant wildlife, and we've sort of pride ourselves on being, you know, ethical hunters and anglers, and I guess we'll talk about that as we take the walk. So what else do you want me to expound on?
Do you interact at all with the agricultural community?
All the time.
Okay.
I mean, yeah.
That's such a big piece of
huge. It's a huge, you know, because it's a, you know, we have, I mean, the basic premise of the public trust doctrine, and Jim Posowitz speaks beautifully about this, is what separates America from Europe is that, in a simple phrase, in Europe, the wildlife, the animals belong to the land, and whomever owns that land basically own the animals.
Oh.
And in America, the wildlife belongs to the people, even when it lives on private land.
Yeah.
It's an ultimate clash between capitalism and socialism, really. You have this public resource, the elk, the deer, that the state, nobody owns it. We don't say the public owns it. We say it is public wildlife. So it is held in trust by the state of Montana for the people of Montana. And that is this ultimate dichotomy is you have, and yet that public resource can come down in one night and destroy $10,000 worth of hay and come back the next night and do it again. So how do we balance this? And that is the, you know, fish, wildlife, and parks just constantly walks a tightrope. It's kind of like everybody's pissed off at fish, wildlife, and parks all the time. The hunters are angry. But at the same time, I mean, hopefully, and we have all day or afternoon or late morning and afternoon to talk about this. I mean, in 1900, there were 5,000 elk in the state of Montana. Oh my God. Today, there are 176,000 elk. So we have a lot to celebrate that, you know, and hunters and anglers led the charge in that. And it's not just, you know, I tell a one simple story that I was fortunate enough to intern at the Outdoor Writers Association of America. It's a very old organization for the hook and bullet writers at newspapers. And we had a hand-signed letter from Richard Nixon on the wall written to the president of the organization. And it said, it was thanking him at the time and said, hunters and anglers will be essential to solving our nation's environmental problems. And you think about where we were in the early 70s, right as we were passing the bedrock environmental laws, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Endangered Species Act, a little later the National Environmental Policy Act, Safe Water Drinking Act. Mm-hmm. What else? Which ones am I forgetting? The really bedrock environmental laws. Yeah. You know, Nixon really had a great record in that, but very progressive. And in fact, the man who literally wrote huge tracts of the Clean Air Act just died a year ago was Leon Billings from Montana. Mm. He was a staffer for Senator Edwin Muskie, who was going to run against Nixon. And Nixon just stole the environment as an issue, just became a champion of it. But anyway, you know, hunters and anglers have a long history of leading the charge because you don't have abundant fish and wildlife if you don't have healthy habitat. And that means clean air and clean soil and clean water. And so, you know, we really largely denuded this continent of wildlife, and now we've slowly put it back together.
Yeah, deer. I was gonna ask about that because you said 5,000 in 1900. And, like, how does that compare with, like, 200 years earlier? Because 1900 was right around the time when, like, the buffalo were reduced to just a few hundred and stuff like that. That was, like, a total crash of
beaver
and,
We don't have, you know, biologists make estimates. And, I mean, you know, we don't have as many elk in North America as we had at the time of European contact. There's no question about that. But slowly, we went from almost wiping out the species, and the last core population was Yellowstone Park. Mm-hmm. And we started transplanting animals out around the state. There's an incredible film that you should all watch called Back from the Brink, and it was produced by the Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Foundation in 2005. And they started taking, you know, 25 of them and turning them loose in an area. So, no, I'm not going to say that we have the numbers that we had at the time of European.
Yeah, no, I was just curious as to what the comparison was. I'm sure.
Historic times.
Yeah, and
post-European contact.
We probably can't approach those just because there's so many humans around now. You know, it's not going to balance out the same way, but I was curious what the...
But there is an argument in that book, 1491, if you've ever read it, that...
No, but I've heard a lot about this book, so I want to read it.
It's a great book.
It's
an amazing book.
Really. The argument is that the native tribes kept the animals in check, and it was the dissemination of the natives that caused the numbers to rise, even the rise of the buffalo, like those buffalo herds were abnormally large because the predator of the human natives was wiped out.
Right.
And then the white people wiped out the
sure.
So maybe even both. Those herds, those herds were abnormally high of what this continent was used to with humans living here.
Yeah.
I guess we'll never know.
Well, you know, biologists make these. I just read a piece 2 months ago that I found absolutely fascinating. It estimates that there are more black bears in North America right now than there were at the time of European contact. The estimate is that right now there are about 800,000 black bears in North America, and this one said that the biologists estimate 500,000 at the time of contact. Well, how do they make that? How do you know? What was the estimate? A species like bison, I would think, based on carrying capacity of the northern Great Plains and the where they lived, it's almost easier. And I'll talk about that today, how we count species and come up with hunting regulations. And I mean, there's a lot to it that I dig into because it's my job. You know, how biologists set seasons and how we, you know, what our tolerance, when I say tolerance, it's a social tolerance for elk. Basically, how many elk a landowner is willing to have on his or her property, you know. And then when you're trying to produce cattle, I mean, there's a limit, you know. But at the same time, I personally have friends who are ranchers and they like wildlife, you know, so. Is that good?
Yeah, I think that's great. I think, are you guys comfortable in this style?
Oh, yeah.
So I'm thinking maybe we'll head up this hill, and when we get to the top, if you're comfortable in kind of giving us...
your classification. And nobody's answered that question. The only answer would come in the Montana State Supreme Court, which we'll get there.
Livestock and as wild animals.
From a legal standpoint,
because
yeah.
Because the wild animals would belong to the people of Montana.
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
That is why when those bison that it went through quarantine for brucellosis for literally 4 to 5 years and were tested and tested and tested were such valuable animals, because that would be your seed stock to reestablish a herd somewhere. So we're having these fights. We've beat back terrible bison bills year after year.
I've seen that bloody roads outside of Gardner.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They've done that skill. Yeah.
Have you thought about raising that issue with the legislature? I mean, they could pass a law which tells you what their answer would be.
Oh, yeah, these aren't friendly times to bring a bill like that. I mean, all we do is fend off the bad bills, you know what I mean? But, yes, and it's, you know, and we'll talk about having that hunt for bison, as messy as it is, if it builds that hunter support, hopefully in the long run, that'll help us reestablish bison. But anyway.
I'd love to just see if you can kind of help us gain our bearings in terms of mountain ranges,
you bet.
Locations.
So we all know, I mean, Canyon Creek is well known. There are a lot of elk out here, but of course, there's a lot of big country, but country like this is so important because this is winter range, and it's kind of when elk are physically forced out of the mountains by snow. You'll notice, and you see those south-facing slopes, how they're open of grass? That is winter range. I mean, elk look for south-facing slopes. They blow free of grass, and of course, they melt off quicker. And a biologist once told me you'll often see elk actually a little higher in the teeth of winter because of those slopes. So this is important. So these elk are migrating. They're coming out of, this is the Continental Divide, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the
Yep, up near, where are we at? Marysville, that
yeah?
way. Yep.
Yeah. And so they're moving down. And when Marissa, I mean, you probably don't see them here much in the summer. They go into those high alpine meadows and they graze on those lush grasses. But it's the cycle of elk like that, and deer ungulates, is pretty remarkable. I mean, the rut is in September for elk, and the cows get they're impregnated. Deer rut is right now, but then they have that gestation all through the winter. So through the toughest time of year, those cows are carrying those calves, and yet these native grasses sustain them all that time. Now they do put on the vast majority of their weight in the final 6 weeks with spring green up. So nature provides those September rains do the final sort of fall green up to get these grasses in condition for those elk to sustain them all winter. So this is really important, and this, we're standing on winter range, which is why you have elk all over the property.
So do they gestate differently than humans? Like, then if they don't have much nutrition during their, except for the last 6 weeks of their gestation, those calves, do they Is it a different kind of gestation than other organisms that have food all year round?
You know, it's that's a good question. They have their, like, the cows are most productive from 2 to about 11, and then a cow elk will live to be close to 20. But they, when they start to get a little older like that, it's much harder on them to carry a calf all the way through, so they might have a calf every other year.
Oh, okay.
See, so those 14, 15-year-old cows aren't, you know,
how fat they get, right, and how much they can
put
metabolize
on
the, yeah, food. Okay.
But
probably,
boy, they will.
Brain development isn't as important for deer either as for
that's
humans.
The what's this?
Brain development.
Yeah. Yeah. But they, you know, they generally, every cow, I know this, biologists have told me this, every cow gets pregnant, but just the ones that don't have
the
aren't in the body condition to carry one through just abort,
okay,
naturally. So.
All right.
But they, I mean, every cow gets pregnant, you know, even the 18-year-old ones or something. But
right,
then they just, they won't, they'll abort through gestation. But
huh,
a lot of times, after about 11, 12, they might produce a calf every other year. And, of course, different landscapes are more productive,
sure, right?
Like, you know, I look at, so when biologists look at the data, they look at something called recruitment rate. And that is, they do their flights over deer and elk in late March. And that is a number, you know, we don't want to look at calves produced because, I mean, to be a little crass, nature's pretty cruel. The mortality rate is just brutally high. But what they want is how many survive the winter. And like down in the Gravelly Range in southwest Montana, they've had recruitment rates of 46 calves per 100 cows, which is more than, that's huge for elk. Up on the Rocky Mountain front, up in the Bob Marshall, that's just not that productive of a landscape. They'll get about 18 or 20 calves per 100 cows. So they fly over winter range of elk. They know where they congregate in the winter, and they'll take a photo of 500 elk there, and they classify that as cows or antlerless, calves, because they can tell by the size, and then of course mature bulls.
So they calf in March?
No, they calf in June.
June
1st.
They do the flyover in March?
They're doing the flyover in March because they want to see how many
from the previous
of the
year
calves
through
carried
the winter
over.
Oh, yeah. I see.
It's
okay.
Overwinter survival.
Okay.
So
over,
the
over.
That term in
okay.
biological science is recruitment. That's calves that made it through winter. Because by late March, they're going to make it,
yeah,
pretty much.
Okay, right.
Yeah. So,
interesting.
But you can also tell them the mortality rate of the adults.
Sure.
Right. Yeah.
Which is almost nothing. I mean, very few elk die.
Huh.
Adults. It's amazing. They. I mean, a few do, but, you know, and hunting is a factor. I mean, hunting is taking some out of the population, but so are predators. And
predators, yeah.
So are, you know, a handful do, but not many. It's pretty remarkable.
Well, they've evolved to survive.
Yeah, they are. elk in particular, Cervus elapis, is a hardy,
wow,
tough species that can adapt to all kinds of species. You know, I'm just talking elk a lot here, but you know, they're more grazers than browsers too. So they eat grasses where elk or deer are more into shrubbery and herbaceous shrubs and bitter brush and sagebrush when they have to, or all of buffalo berry. And all
my front lawn.
The stuff you put in you live in town.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, these are the kind of landscapes, and that's one of the things we work so. I mean, I work a lot with the Nature Conservancy, and we have our Habitat Montana program, which pays for land purchases of key parcels, but also as wildlife management areas, but also easements on private farms and ranches. You know, that we want to keep from being developed or heavily developed. That, you know, fractures migration routes, cuts into winter range. And,
yeah, that's what I was wondering about. It's like, The fractures seem to be a big problem. If you get like isolated spots, they don't do much good because they need a lot of space to move around in, right?
Yeah. I'll just tell one story that, I mean, when I was a reporter, I spent a lot of time with Fred King, who was the Region 3. Montana for fish and wildlife management is divided into 7 regions, and we're in Region 3, which is southwest Montana. And I drove around with him a lot down in the Madison Valley, and the what is today the Wall Creek Game Range. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Madison, but there was a biologist named Arnie Foss who was in 1960 standing on the highway in the teeth of winter, and he looked out and counted about 160 elk. And he said, you know, this is a natural winter range. We need to get this in public hands. And we bought that. We bought that in 1961. Today, and they've added to it through the years, but today if you stand in that same spot in the teeth of winter, there are 2,600 elk out there.
And where do you get your money to buy the property?
That is a SURF fee on hunting and licenses.
Oh, nice.
That goes into the Habitat Montana program. Yeah. And then, of course, that is seed money to get matching federal dollars through the Land and Water Conservation Fund, and private foundation dollars from the Nature Conservancy or the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation or different land trusts. So it's all different groups pooling in money, as well as some of our, you know, occasionally for smaller projects, some of our local affiliates are, you know, because we have 14 affiliates around the state that are your local rod and gun clubs. So
that actually brings up a question that was raised by someone in the audience from the last walk that we did, that now that there's sort of a kind of a cultural shift that they're generationally, and most of our friends are coming from this, now what? How are we going to start funding lands, and this offer's no longer going to be a resource?
Right. Or as much. It'll always be a resource. But yeah, I would say that is the conservation challenge. I mean, our timing on this talk is really good, because Fish, Wildlife, and Parks gets almost zero general fund dollars. Very few people know that. That has a blessing and a curse, because, as you know, tomorrow 150 people are showing up for a special session, and hopefully all of our programs are fine. They're not going to come raid our pots of money, although they try, but we usually beat them back. But so it has that advantage to it, but at the same time, everybody loves wildlife. Everybody enjoys wildlife in different ways. Some people don't want to hunt, and that's okay, but they go out with binoculars or just like to go wildlife watching, and I do too. But we need to get them paying into the management of those species, and that's the conservation challenge of the 21st century. But I will say, within the next couple weeks, there will be a federal bill dropped in called the Recovering America's Wildlife Act that would pump $1.2 billion into state wildlife agencies, and the money would come actually from the petroleum industry. And so there's an example of something the National Wildlife Federation, as well as state affiliates, will be working on. And, you know, if you go to our Montana Wildlife Federation Facebook page and all of our website, we'll be pushing a lot when that bill is introduced.
So is
given the political climate, how did that happen?
Well, and I'll tell you, it's a long-term strategy.
Okay.
I'll explain one. The Land and Water Conservation Fund is now 50 years old. It takes a portion of the royalties from offshore oil and gas lease revenue for the federal government and puts it into this fund, and then that money goes for things like your park down the city, your little kiddie park down the street, or land purchases. And, you know, any type of conservation project, a hockey rink. I mean, it's been one of the most successful programs ever. And so this new bill is kind of modeled on that. And the motivation of the petroleum industry is to keep species from going on the endangered species list.
So let's do some proactive
conservation. Right. It's a good bill. It had more momentum, frankly, before Trump was elected.
That's a shock.
Yeah. But, you know, it's a long-term strategy. We drop in the bill now, and, I mean, these federal bills can take 6-7 years.
We just need another giant oil spill so they feel really guilty. They're like, oh, but we funded this wildlife bill.
Yeah. And I don't kid yourself. They want to keep, you know, right now the Endangered Species Act is more threatened than it's ever been.
Yeah,
bills are dropped in 6 or 7 to really curtail the bill, and we will be at the forefront of fighting those.
So,
that brings up, an interesting question, because, like, you know, a lot of people would say, well, if we could, you know, stop using oil tomorrow and use completely renewable solar, wind, or whatever, we'd do it. But it sounds like that would actually impact you know, programs like this, because they're actually getting money from the the oil industry. Is like, is there a long-term plan to kind of transition away from that funding? And where will it come from afterwards?
Right. Well, it seems like that could also apply, though, if now the new technology or the grader is coming from renewable or alternative, then now they're the ones that are contributing as well.
Yeah, no, but it is a good... I mean, we're not going to... It'd be great, but we're not going to wean ourselves of oil tomorrow.
No, I know.
But we are going to go to energy. We'll still need oil for automobiles and those kind of things. It's a good question. I mean,
the state is grappling it right now. Yeah. I mean, we've lost all this income from our coal, taxing and stuff. And what do you do? And so,
So I brought up Land and Water Conservation Fund, and I've mentioned a new bill. The other one, of course, which was 1937, 80 years, was the Pippin-Robertson Act. And that is the excise tax on sporting guns and fire and ammunition and sporting equipment. And that goes into a fund. And that is distributed by the federal government to state wildlife agencies. And that is unquestionably one of the most successful programs in our nation's history, because it has very stringent standards on what the money can be used for. It is used for wildlife. Okay. And, you know, states can't build bridges with it, and they can't build schools. Not that those aren't worthy causes, but this money will go to wildlife. And every time they try to tinker with it, you know, we beat it back. And I'm amazed that a program, I mean, hunters in the throes of the Depression said, we're willing to tax ourselves for this. And it's been, you know, it's been a real blessing that they put such stringent standards on that. And in fact, I know from friends of mine in conservation that the Trump administration literally was looking to take some of those funds to build the wall.
Oh, shit.
And they had attorneys look at it and were like, don't go there. I'm serious. I have friends in D.C. who, you know, so, and then the counterpart to that was the Dingell Johnson Fund, and that funds fishing equipment, tackle and equipment for water, for fisheries and clean water, as well as fisheries projects and fishery access sites. And so they're two great programs.
What strikes me about your discussion of your organization is a lot of discussion around the world is about the rights of nature, like, did nature have rights? And and you're saying that there are these obscure rights of, if the wildlife is the most important beneficiary of your work, and they have funding, nature has funding.
Yeah,
it sounds like a good example of giving nature rights without calling it out as such.
Yeah. I call it an anthropocene. I mean, people say, well, and I respect this. I understand. They're like, so you want to conserve these species so you can go kill them, basically. And I'm like, well, it's an anthropocentric view of nature.
It's what we need from
nature. I mean, we need people, you know, it's hunters are, well, in the past, have been some of the most committed conservationists. And it's getting them to understand that, you know, you don't just show up and these things happen. You know, we have, it took decades to get where we are today. And it's kind of ironic because we have more wildlife than ever and fewer hunters, you know? So
is your organization trying to increase the number of hunters or find a different funding source, or both?
Both.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. I some people have said, so I want to go back a little bit. Wildlife is managed by state wildlife agencies in our country with two exceptions. Migratory waterfowl, because they cross state lines dramatically, so we can't just let hunters in Louisiana shoot 60 a day and people up in the north shoot one or something, and endangered species. And that's why the Endangered Species Act is such a powerful law. I mean, that is an emergency room just saying something's not working here. I mean, this species is on the cusp of blinking out, and states can't handle it. And that's when the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service steps in. So that's the role of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Migratory waterfowl and endangered species, and then of course managing our nationwide system of national wildlife refuges, which are hundreds of millions of acres. And that has, Teddy Roosevelt had a big hand in.
And they're not just bird sanctuaries? Mostly birds.
Oh, there are all kinds of things. National. Yeah, a lot of it has to do with birding, but
because of the migratory nature.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, so every year, biologists, senior biologists with Fish, Wildlife, and Parks go to D.C. when they allow, they set what each state's bag limits can be for ducks and geese.
Okay.
So they've set, you know, and they make agreements, and then that comes out in their regs. So. But yeah, the National Wildlife Refuge system did have a lot to do with waterfowl. It's a lot of wetlands. And,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's also, you know, tundra or places in Alaska.
Mm, yeah. Okay.
Well, you said that historically the hunters have been some of the most passionate conservationists. Is the culture changing now, do you think? Is it?
I think it has, yeah. I think that. There's always been, for decades, been that split where people call them, you know, your greenies or whatever, and it's just getting them to understand that you're not going to have abundant wildlife if you don't have healthy habitat, you know, and it's like, I feel like a whole, you know, I'm 46 years old, and I feel like a whole generation has grown up in the era of abundance.
Yeah.
And they say, I want to go back in the ways it used to be, and as Jim Posowitz puts it, no, you don't. You know, it's, I watched that tape Back from the Brink. I mean, they interviewed some of the old, they're all dead now, most of them, but they interviewed guys in their 80s who had a big hand in this restoration effort, and they said, back in the day when you went out hunting, and if you cut a deer track, it was a big deal, and when I say you went out hunting, you got a 2-day season.
Yeah.
Mm.
We have a 5-week general deer and elk season. Look what we crossed on the walk here. I mean, you know, and it's just getting, it's like so many things, and it's like, you know, people say, you know, dilution is the solution to pollution. You're like, really? Like, they didn't pass the Clean Water Act until rivers were on fire. How much fish are you going to have? The Cuyahoga burned in downtown Cleveland, you know. So I think we have to have a big hand in educating the modern, you know, the generation of hunters. They grew up in the era of abundance, you know. And I hear things out of hunters, and I'm like, do you listen to yourself? You know. So it's frustrating at times, but. Aside from a really great conservation record out of the Obama administration, clean water rule, you know, clean air, ton new national monuments. We're heavily engaged in defending the Antiquities Act and the national monuments, which were all very justified monuments. But, you know, that's a big part of it, land protection.
I mean, mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Teddy Roosevelt's legacy. I went to D.C. twice on the Rocky Mountain Front Heritage Act and getting that passed. That was one of the happiest days of my life.
All right. Well, thanks.
When was that passed?
2014.
Okay. Good news. Last couple of years.
Yeah. And it was a good, it was a great bill. It added 67,000 acres of wilderness as well as 200,000 acres of conservation management area, which basically keeps it as it is. The existing roads stay open, but there's very few. And so.
Well, I went to a dinner last year with Arrow and some hunter association and Thomas.
That was us?
Huh?
You were there, yeah.
Yeah, Thomas Bymaster, that statistic he gave about 10.5 million pounds of meat harvested from Montana.
Yeah.
And you talk about local food. I mean, so then you start engaging the local food people because that's such a huge resource.
Yep.
Where you studied under Dana, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so with biomimicry, that's the connection.
Right, yeah.
I'm thinking, okay, maybe we'll get our feet moving a little
bit.
It's out at our office.
Wyoming's elk feeding program, which is the largest wildlife feeding program on earth, where they throw out alfalfa pellets. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with the issue, but there are 23 feed grounds in Wyoming.
For their hunting seasons? Is
well, just
why?
For the winter.
I mean, because they want those animals why do they do it?
It has deep historic roots. The elk, it's been going on for 100 years, and the Jackson Hole Valley is very bitter winters, as we know.
Right.
And the elk used to move through there and head to the Red Desert, but one winter a bunch died, and they started, you know, feeding them, and it just became habit, and that's the National Elk Refuge there.
Oh.
And the guy who actually ran the program was the wildlife biologist. His name is Bruce Smith. He lives in Bozeman. He's retired now. And he spent his career running the program and publicly talking about how this is bad wildlife policy. Those elk have foot rot, scabies. You're congregating animals, and that spreads. They have higher incidence of brucellosis. And when chronic wasting disease gets there, it's going to be a big vector when you're putting these animals nose to nose.
So how is that spread, chronic wasting disease?
Well, they have to come in each contact with each other, right, with mucus, feces, urine, but it's a prion.
It's a prion.
So it stays in the soil. This was a big deal this week. Most common in mule deer, literally Tuesday, I was at the Fish and Wildlife Commission where we were talking about our statewide chronic wasting disease management plan. And this during the hearing, they got the call. The biologist, that they'd had their first positive test because they stepped up monitoring down there. So,
is there a way to destroy the prions in the soil?
No state that has had chronic wasting disease have they ever wiped out the disease.
So once it's in, it's there. It stays.
It's there. What Wisconsin went on, depopulating entire areas of deer in an effort to get rid of it, and they couldn't do it.
It's related to mad cow disease.
Yeah.
And, you know, in England, they just had to, kill
everything.
It wiped out the beef industry.
If you went hiking in a farm, you had to get your feet, decontaminated before you could move on to the next area.
Yeah.
So it's nasty stuff. Yeah. Wow.
Interesting. Yeah, so that's too bad. So I used to live in Boulder County in Colorado, and they were going to wipe out a whole herd of deer from chronic wasting disease, and the public went crazy. You're going to kill Bambi. Give me a break. Okay, no, let's let him die slow and miserable, and spread the disease. People are so uneducated if they're not hunters, like you're saying.
Sure.
Or know about wildlife.
Yeah. Well, and I will say there were some nasty things said about me from the Elk Breeders Association of America over the Arby story.
I want you to tell them about that, because I think some people haven't heard this yet.
But they said this is the closest some don't. I read this in some of the ag press. Don't they understand that this is the closest some people will ever come to wildlife?
Arby's venison sandwich.
From a farm race, I will say with a lot of pride that the Montana Wildlife Federation led the charge in 2000 to ban game farms in Montana. Still have signs in our office: keep elk wild and free, vote for I-143. And that
did it pass?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. When was that?
2000.
And you banned all the game farms?
All game farms.
And then what happened to all those animals?
Well, that's a good I don't know. The ones that were there were grandfathered in, so there are still some game farms in Montana. But these were captive shooting operations where you had a 10-acre people. I mean, and if that's all you get from hunting, then that's not a fair chase. And again, Jim Posowitz, he once went on NBC News on a feature, an hour-long feature about is this hunting, and he has a simple explanation about what is a fair chase hunt. The animal has a reasonable chance to get away. That's a fair chase, where you're out pursuing it in open lands and it can get away. It's not a captive shooting operation. But those are also terrible for disease spread. Again, you're congregating them. You are turning wildlife into livestock. So
kind of the way the plague spread in humans.
So, Marissa, what's our next agenda item? there's a bull that steps out at 300 yards and it's a windy day and you're breathing hard. I mean, do you just start shooting, or do you wait, or do you try to get closer, there's a lot wrong with hunting right now. I won't deny that. There's this obsession with long-range shooting and people boasting about hitting an elk at 800 yards, and it's like, really? Why didn't you take that opportunity to move in closer and put a good stock on it? I'll give you a personal example. And 2 years ago, I, in the evening, hit a cow elk and hit her poorly, not in the vitals, and tractor and tractor and tractor, and I just couldn't catch up to her, and I felt really bad about it. So that it was getting dark, and I hiked out, and I mean, I passed up bull elk, and passed up several elk on the hike out. Like, I was bumped, there were elk everywhere that day. And I got in there first thing in the morning and came right up that same ridge line, and there she was, dead. And I quartered her up and saved all the meat, cooled it off as quick as I could, and I felt really good about at least going, instead of shooting up. I mean, I had a second elk tag in my pocket. I could have shot one of those bulls, but I said, no, I'm going to exhaust, you know, everything I can to recover this animal. So, you know, that's an ethical dilemma when you hit, you know, tracking down an animal that's wounded. I mean, not choosing when not to take a shot. But at the same time, if you're going to be an effective hunter, you need to shoot eventually, right? And it's just, there's so much to it.
You know? So how do you teach those ethics to hunters? Like, how do you carry that message across?
Sure, you teach them to practice with their
rifle. Where do you teach that?
Hunter's education.
Yeah. Like, no, as part of the licensing process?
Oh, yeah, kids.
Is that required?
Yeah.
The gun safety laws?
Oh, yeah, kids go through hunter's ed, although they passed a law in 2015 that allows an apprentice hunter, and this was outside state money, so a 10-year-old can go with a supervising adult. But then
without
eventually
having the hunter safety.
Yeah, and we were opposed to the bill, and it was, but it, a lot of money was thrown behind it, and they beat us. I mean, it was, but that said, it's working fairly well as far as hunting accidents. But then our goal is, in fact, we tweaked that bill this past session here in 2017 to get those kids so they can go a year or two with a mentor, it's called, and then get them in the hunter ed program. Because we don't have a problem in Montana in recruiting new hunters. Montana has the highest per capita participation in hunting and fishing in the nation.
I'm not surprised.
Remember when I talked about 5,000 elk in Montana? I would say that we, all of us, but hunters, but everyone, spent decades restoring wildlife and cleaning up our environment, right? I mean, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, all that stuff I talked about, building these herds up. And now we're more in an era of maintaining what we have. I would, you know, I had the good fortune of going to a talk in April of just last, of 2016 with Leon Billings, who literally wrote the Clean Air Act. Like I said, I mean, he was the staffer, you know, what a legacy. He called it Clean Water and Clean Air, the people's laws. Those laws have been attacked ever since they were passed. Hundreds of millions of dollars in lobbying thrown at them, and we've maintained them. So, you know, I would say today, one, from a wildlife management, I mean, the nuts and bolts of hunting seasons and all that, we now live in the era of abundance, and it's how we manage that. So, you know, we have, in some cases, we actually have in each hunting district an objective. This is the number of elk we want to see. And we have struggle getting down to those numbers. We have hunting districts that have five times the number of elk.
So how do you get down to the number?
But in particular, what do you hunt? And this gets, you regulate populations by killing females because they're the reproducers in essence.
Oh.
So that's how many, you know, cow elk you allow to be killed in any one district. And so that used to be by permit only. We have numerous hunting districts in southwest Montana where you can kill cow elk with your general over-the-counter elk license. And our grandfathers would have never dreamed of that kind of hunting opportunity. You know, they didn't even think about killing cow elk because they said when you kill a cow, you're killing two elk. Well, that's a mindset of trying to build elk, build elk, build elk, and now we've done that, and we have this abundance, and now it's how do you manage that?
And so do out-of-state hunters play a big role in that?
Oh, yeah, but there's a notion, and it's somewhat true, that a lot of people just absolutely want to kill a bull, and they're interested in trophy hunting, and this opens up. And I have found, I mean, I just spent 5 days in a southwest Montana valley that draws a lot of non-resident hunters, and that's not entirely true. Plenty of hunters are happy to put their tag on a cow elk. You know, they just want hunting opportunity. Some aren't. Some want a bull at all costs, you know. I personally, in my life, I've killed 11 elk and 4 bulls and 7 cows, you know. So, but it's an interesting, I mean, I'll just give you a real brief snapshot of what wildlife management looks like. You know the herd, so what I was talking about earlier, they count the herd on winter range. They pick days where they've purposely been pushed low. They know the bull-cow ratio. They know the calf production. They make an estimate that there's a certain percentage of elk were still in the timber to get their estimate of that herd size. They know the hunting success. They know the number of hunters who generally went out and what we call hunter days in that district.
Because why?
It's a phone survey. Okay. So they do a survey at the end of the season and call half the hunters. And that is anybody who knows statistical samples, that's an incredible sample size. Yeah. They make an estimate of the number of elk killed in that district, and then they give confidence intervals. They know that, let's just say hypothetically, you're trying to kill 100 elk in this district. You need to issue 100 cow elk. You need to issue 250 cow licenses because the success rate is about 33% or 40% or something. But statewide, the number of people who buy an elk license and actually kill one is about 20%. 1 out of 5 hunters who buys an elk tag actually kills one.
And this is handled through the state Fish and Wildlife Service.
Yeah.
In
2015, I haven't seen the numbers for 2016, was the largest elk kill ever in historic state history. We killed 30,000 elk in the state in the hunting seasons. And So, how many you issue. And I was asked this in the Arby story by a journalist. They said, well, isn't selling a hunting license commercialization? Aren't you buying that elk? And I said, or he didn't put it quite that way. And I said, no, what you are paying for when you buy an elk license for $24 from the state is the opportunity to go elk hunting. It doesn't guarantee you an elk. So, a lot of these issues, I mean, what I was talking about earlier with cattle ranchers or landowners, when these elk come down, you know, we need their help to allow some level of public hunting to redistribute them across the landscape. If they're, you know, there are some places, this gets into the commercialization of wildlife, that just sell trophy bull hunts, and then the day that the season's over, they go and complain that they're being eaten out of business. Well, you know, the agency, Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, will help them, but they have to help us too by, you know, creating some level of hunting pressure to both manage numbers as well as distribute them across the landscape, because elk learn very quickly where they're safe.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and so they will. And some properties don't allow any hunting, and that's their choice. You can't force a landowner to allow public hunters, but if they're having issues, they need to have some type of public access program to help us manage those animals.
So if there were too many elk on this area, would you let Marissa come out and say, okay, you can go kill 20 this year because nobody
something
else
like
can
that.
Go hunting?
But I'm not telling you have to allow hunters. If you're comfortable with the number you have.
No, but not allow hunters, but let the owner hunt and let the owner kill and say, well.
No, because those are public wildlife and that's a kill permit. And that would, they do in very rare, but no, then you have a game damage hunt. See,
you say, okay, Marissa, we'll have a game damage hunt on your land. And
yeah, and put 20 hunters on the landscape or something. How many, Marissa, do you get in the heart of winter? Have you had up to 200 elk on the property?
I have
150.
Honey, 150-ish. Yeah, there's a lot.
What would you feel about that? If he came and said,
well,
we need 20 hunters next week to come because we're going to cull your herd.
Well, in relative to how our conservation easement is written, it wouldn't actually be an option anyhow.
If it was up to you, what would you say? That would be a hard decision.
Yeah, my gut is I'd probably lean to no.
You would let the elk overpopulate.
I'd coax them out in some other way. I'd sit down and talk with them.
She has a magic flute.
I have other measures, but no, it's that's a difficult question.
Nobody's asking me because, you know, I don't have that issue, but that would be a hard, because I'm not opposed to hunting, but if somebody said we're going to come on your property and kill.
Yeah, I mean, even how this one is.
The elk today.
So how the easement is written for the kind of the greater 1,300 acres, there is, you know, no hunting, no fishing, no, on this little pond, no trapping, no anything. However, if a biologist comes in and determines in this sense that there is an overpopulation, it does open up avenues that you are, and it would be a personal decision you are allowed to within certain limits. So I think they even recognize that it's a real issue and you should have the ability to potentially address that. But I think you were asking me more of a personal question.
Right.
It would be a tough one for me.
I'm not a hunter.
And I'm not anti-hunting, but I myself am not a hunter.
A lot of people are worried about 50 guys coming up in trucks than actually the loss of 50.
Only if you carpool.
Yeah, exactly. But here's what we're after in a broad brush is what you don't want. The ideal scenario is to spread the hunters out and spread the wildlife out. So if you have a bunch of properties if you have an area that's just getting hit really hard with hunters, and then an area that gets no hunting, the elk learn that very quickly, and they congregate there. So you can have one property that becomes a refuge, and you're not reaching your management goals. Now, that said,
and it's there's destroying that property, too.
If it's destroying that property, but you have no problem with 150 elk on the property, and there's enough forage for them here. So I'm not... The objectives are set based on landowner tolerance. I've got a great example from the last, and this shows you what we're dealing with right now in elk management. There's the Blacktail Mountain Range south of Dillon, and I had one winter where I lived in Dillon, and I went in that mountain range and I hunted hard all day, and I saw two elk up there on the public land. I came down driving in the mid-afternoon, 3 o'clock, into Dillon, and there were 650 elk standing in a center pivot, standing there. And that landowner charged for hunters, charged a different rate for bulls and cows, did it for years. Eventually, another 1,000 head showed up, and he said enough. And he called Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, and they crafted an access program. Last year on that ranch, that one ranch, they killed 300 elk.
Wow.
But the elk have been pushed back up onto the public land. I've been told that, and I actually know, ironically, that landowner's son has one of her pups. A small world. But also, I've been told he is the single largest hay producer in Montana, and they estimate that their ranch losses of hay to elk were $250,000 of forage eaten. And so,
but he brought it on himself. Then,
he
right?
did, and that's my point: is that it's your prerogative to feed as much wildlife as you want within limits. But if you're not allowing people on at all, and you're charging, and you're getting an overabundance of elk, then you need to reevaluate. Like, you know, it's a classic line: we'll help you, but you got to help us too.
So
it has to be a partnership between landowners and hunters. They're interesting issues. There's where I'm going. Mm-hmm. The public's wildlife on your private land.
Right. So in a situation like that, would some kind of scare tactic work to eliminate them off your land?
Like, sometimes.
Like he could do dynamite explosion. Sure.
Dynamiting up the nude, nude hot springs.
but you know, we do need to...
Those elk are nude.
We need to manage numbers, and that means killing a certain number of cows.
Okay. Because in his case, it wasn't just that they congregated on his place, but they also too many in the whole area.
Well, and how do they push your neighbor who does allow hunting? And even if they're on your place during the day, do they end up on your neighbor's field at night? I mean, they're complicated issues, you know. And I know they do tremendous damage to fences as well.
Oh, really? Okay.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it can cost the landowner a lot.
So big.
we're not blind to the challenges they face in, you know, managing wildlife. But it, again, it has to be a partnership.
But so you said earlier that, you know, you've gone from trying to build up the herds to like maintain. And how do you know, like, what the magic number is? Is it just how much the land can sustain, or how much impact there is on the on the surrounding property, or how do you pick that number?
Each hunting district has an elk objective, is the term.
Right.
And that is set, and this is where we get into the, this is, that objective is 100% a social construct.
Okay.
It's what landowners are willing to tolerate. It's we have 176,000 elk in Montana. We could probably have 1 million if landowners are willing to use the word tolerate, but in the end of the day, feed them.
Do you know what the care and capacity of the state is for elk? Like, would you
great
have
question.
A,
yeah. I mean, you know, there.
You say we could have 1 million elk in Montana.
Right. Well, maybe 500,000. I mean, you know, I don't know. I don't know. Nobody
just
knows.
Just kind of guess because we don't.
There's a different. There'd be different numbers if there were no humans here.
Right? Yeah, well, yeah. And we live on a complex landscape that includes farms and ranches and mines and roads and towns, and you know, it's. I mean, that's what makes my job so much fun and interesting. They're interesting issues, but. What, you know, the entire capacity is a social construct. You know, we're not going to have elk in downtown Helena, and although we do have deer. But, you know, different species. But, I mean, there is a social tolerance for these animals. And, you know, hunters would like more and more and more. Landowners want fewer. That's the tightrope that Fish, Wildlife, and Parks walks every day. And so...
Just being a sort of gun pops, yeah. And in fact, this area is around there. Yep.
Could be a herd. I want to bring. I mean, I'm going to go into a total ecological issue off the subject, but here's one of our biggest issues: are this
knapweed.
Spotted knapweed, right there. That is a non-native Eurasian plant that crowds out native grasses and reduces forage. And that, that's a huge issue in conservation, and there are numerous other species of weeds. The other one that Marissa has is cheatgrass.
Yeah, just started coming in, cheatgrass. That's actually right along the road section. Some toad flax as well, not too much of
leafy
that.
We've spurge.
Got that little bit of leafy spurge. The biggest has been knapweed, at least for us, I know. Two of the property owners, we've been doing weevil releases. I think we're in the second year, but it's you have another 3 to 4 years before you really start seeing.
They do work, though.
They do. We've definitely noticed.
The beetles for which?
For the spotted knapweed.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Good job.
Yeah,
it'll pay off. It's a long-term project. That stuff works.
Yeah, it's actually pretty cool to see them go to work too.
We did a biomimicry project on invasive species down the Great Sand Dunes, and we looked at how nature deals with the disturbance because they had dug up to put in new underground lines, electrical lines, and then the invasive species come in there. It was interesting. To work with the biologists and see how native grasses and everything can crowd out invasives, but you have to.
Yep.
It's all these conditions. It was interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll give you another. Here's a great example of a modern issue, and I'm really proud of this one. But a big issue environmentally across the country is feral pigs.
Oh yeah,
and
Marin, we had those.
They do.
Oh yeah, they're a serious problem
in Marin,
California.
They do $1.5 billion in crop and property damage throughout the country.
Feral pigs,
oh,
really?
Yeah, in the Santa Cruz Mountains, they are thick. But they in the South Texas, Florida, Georgia. There are 44 states have them. Montana, as far as we know, doesn't. And we came in on a bill with the ag industry in 2015, and we passed a very carefully written statute that if they are detected in Montana, you cannot shoot them, but there's money and the resources for the agency to go out and eradicate them. And people would say, well, why wouldn't you want someone to shoot them? In the South, it's popular sport to go hunt them.
Yeah, my brothers do it, yeah.
And so where I'm going at with this is as soon as an animal has a constituency, look out. They actually charge in Texas to go hunt these feral pigs. They tout them sometimes as an amenity of the property.
Oh,
and
really?
Yet they're doing all this damage. They eat songbirds. They eat deer fawns. They're incredibly intelligent. They can reproduce at crazy rates. So now I'll throw out, and this is getting more and more attention, wild horses.
Oh.
They are non-native to North America. They're growing rapidly. The BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, spends $80 million
really?
A year
that much?
Managing wild horses.
And people just go outraged if they kill them.
There are more than 70 wild horse advocacy organizations. Oh, and, you know, I'm a... And so, and if you think now cattle, horses will denude range. Horses will take native forage to the nub.
Yeah. Wow.
I mean, they eat. You know this, remember? Mm-hmm. They can pound a landscape. And yet, in 1971, they passed the Wild Horse and Burro Act, and that law never that law was written. I was told largely to address the inhumane treatment they were getting, but it never envisioned letting their numbers go unchecked. And in fact, one of the key experts on that law is a professor of wildlife biology at Montana State University, Bob Garrett. And it's interesting times because their numbers grow, and yet we'll never hunt them. I know that would be just absolutely abhorrent to a lot of people, and yet we need to control their numbers.
Well,
it's a fascinating issue.
Maybe someday hungry enough. I don't know.
Well, and there's no, the animals that people eat are an entirely a cultural concept.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's true.
My ex-wife is French, and they eat horse. Yeah. And there's just no market in North America for horse meat.
People would go berserk.
So
or
what do you
dog,
do? What do you do?
It's all right, Sapphire.
Same question with the pigs. So if wild pigs showed up in Montana, you don't want to hunt them. What do? Do you poison them? Do you...
You very aggressively, yes, you do anything and everything to keep them in the state. They're bad for our native wildlife species. They're
so
bad.
So you kill them, but you don't issue a hunting license.
Right,
them.
Yeah.
But you get the agency to do it. What was one of the impetuses for that bill? A guy near Anaconda wanted to release them on his property.
Oh,
so
okay.
Now, that angers me.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. What is the...
Tell him about Australia and the rabbits.
You don't want to create a constituency that becomes advocates for wild pig hunting in Montana. We live in a state with 11 species of native big game species that we hunt. And, why we would want to bring in non-native feral pigs that do tremendous environmental damage and harm our agriculture industry is beyond me. I don't understand it. And it angers me that someone would try to do that. Now, in full disclosure, in my hypocrisy, I do love to hunt pheasants. And pheasants are from China. But they're also not wreaking havoc on the environment. And that's the difference, I say, here's a non-native species right there, spotted knapweed, that is wreaking havoc on the environment.
Shoot it.
They're interesting. They're fascinating issues, That some people would say, well, those horses are wild now. And I'd say, yeah, but they're also doing... Down in the Pryor Mountains in southwest, south of Billings, there is a wild horse herd in Montana. And that used to be really good mule deer hunting in there, and it's virtually devoid of deer. So
would there be ways to,
It's your animal versus mine, really. That's
I mean, this would be ways to get contraceptives into their food.
They're doing some of that.
They're doing some of that.
They're doing all kinds of stuff, and they're trying to reopen a horse slaughterhouse somewhere in New Mexico or somewhere, maybe it's gotten a lot of press. There's a whole national working group working on wild horses because it's such an issue.
To let just Native Americans hunt them to work with,
the Native American, the Navajo Rez in northwest New Mexico has a huge wild horse population. And I saw a great piece on PBS NewsHour saying, and the guy said, we love our wild horses, but we also love our land. And we can't let these things.
Let them.
So, I'm not gonna go there.